From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, coming to you from KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma today. Jeremy, we're visiting listeners, but we're also keeping an eye on the weather. There's the possibility of tornadoes in the northern part of the state into Kansas today.
So stay safe there in Oklahoma. Yeah. Meanwhile, in the Caribbean Sea, Hurricane Matthew has made landfall in Haiti with maximum sustained winds of up to 145 miles per hour. It's also bringing heavy rain, perhaps up to 25 inches in some places. Matthew is also affecting Jamaica and Cuba and is now expected to head north over the next several days and impact the east coast of the U.S. Today, the National Hurricane Center issued a hurricane watch for much of Florida's Atlantic coast. For more, we're joined by Dr. Greg Postel, a hurricane and storm specialist from the Weather Channel. Can you first give us just the latest?
Yes, the Hurricane Matthew now is moving back over water after making an initial landfall in the western tip of Haiti, and probably weakened a little bit as it did, but should regain some strength as it moves northward through the Bahamas during the day tomorrow and Thursday on a path that brings it eventually much closer to the United States than perhaps some thought a couple of days ago.
Well, and I want to ask about that in a few minutes, but first of all, what's happening right now? We've heard the word catastrophic thrown around as the potential impact on Haiti. What are your concerns?
A heavy rainfall, mudslides, flash flooding, the like that comes with that, and of course the destructive winds where the very core of Matthew went over. Winds over 100 miles per hour were almost certainly felt in a small area within about 20 or 30 miles from the center where it came ashore. But outside of that, the winds rapidly decreased, but what we really were concerned about more so than anything else was the widespread flooding. And you know, Haiti's undergone significant deforestation, so rain falling on top of the mountains didn't have much in its way. It just flowed down and brought, unfortunately, probably mudslides and maybe led to some of that catastrophic destruction that was anticipated.
And what do you anticipate when it comes to impacts on Jamaica and Cuba?
Impacts in Jamaica, relatively minor. Matthew took a turn a little bit away from Jamaica in the last couple of days, so they all only experienced the periphery of Matthew with winds really not so strong, 20 to 30 plus miles per hour, and not a whole lot of rain either. The eastern tip of Cuba, however, later on today, may get a very close encounter with the core of Matthew, which would bring those hurricane conditions and the heavy rain, but only for a brief moment, because by later on this afternoon and tonight should come back over the water again if it does make landfall over Cuba and move through the Bahamas tomorrow. That's the next step.
And by the way, the National Hurricane Center says this is the first Category 4 hurricane to make landfall in Haiti since Hurricane Cleo back in 1964. So it's been some time since they've had a hurricane of this magnitude.
Yeah, it's been some time, but you know, these hurricanes kind of move in time in their own way and develop in certain places, certain years, and sometimes people just get lucky. And unfortunately, this is one of those times where Haiti was not so lucky.
So what do you expect will happen once the storm makes its way further to the north and possibly impacts the United States?
I think we're going to see impacts in the United States regardless now of what happens to future forecasts that come in. I really think we need to start thinking about what to do if a hurricane, a major hurricane potentially, makes landfall anywhere from, say, Florida, South Florida, all the way up through the Carolinas, at least. Beyond that, it's a little bit more uncertain. But the expected track will likely take the center of Matthew pretty close to Florida on Friday, coming in late Thursday night and Friday. We think that the center will be moving far enough offshore to keep the hurricane force winds offshore, but we'll see destructive waves and coastal flooding and beach erosion regardless. But that's the expected track. There is still some wiggle room left in the forecast. If this were to move closer, then those bets are off, and we have a much worse situation weather-wise, which would bring damaging winds onshore. That's for Florida. But downstream, there is seem to be some confidence that it will get even closer to the coast, the center of Matthew will, than it does in Florida. There is a good chance, I think, that it gets very close, if not makes landfall, in northern South Carolina or southern North Carolina over the weekend. If you live in places from Charleston on up all the way through Cape Hatteras, might as well go ahead and prepare, as I said earlier, for a landfall. In case it doesn't happen, that's great news. It's a win-win. But if it does make landfall, you want to be prepared because it could be a 100-plus mile-per-hour hurricane moving in that area. And if it does make landfall, then we have a whole other set of problems, including storm surge, which is one of the greatest killers of landfalling hurricanes, and, of course, the damaging winds to go along with that.
And we've still got how much time left in the hurricane season?
Well, technically, the hurricane season ends November 30th, but really the bulk of it where you can expect this kind of weather really should begin. The odds of a hurricane like this in the Western Atlantic or Caribbean Sea go way down as we head from about the middle of October onward. So hopefully this is hurricane season's last gasp. No guarantees, but let's hope. Statistics in the past suggest that it just might be.
That's Dr. Greg Postel, a hurricane and storm specialist with the Weather Channel. Dr. Postel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, back here in Oklahoma, we're also keeping an eye on potential severe weather with our local KGOU Here and Now newscaster, the appropriately named Storm Jones. But we also want to dip into the politics of the region with state impact reporter Logan Layden, who joins us in the KGOU studios. And Logan, at one time, this was a progressive state, the populist Will Rogers, you know, an Okie, and that's not a pejorative. But this is a solid Republican legislature now. Remind us.
Yeah, no, we do have a progressive history here in Oklahoma. And even up until the late 90s and early 2000s, our state legislature was dominated by Democrats. Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't voted for a Democrat for president since back in 1964, and we're not going to this year. Donald Trump has a massive lead in Oklahoma just from the little handful of polls that I've seen, mm-hmm. and he has nothing to worry about here. Show him up about 24 points. Now, I will say Romney and McCain both won by more than 30 points in Oklahoma, and we'll have to wait and see the final tally after the election. So maybe there's a little bit less support for Trump, but he's going to win in a landslide.
He's the winner. So the talk here, and I'm looking at the papers, is about a fascinating ballot question. Start with what's been successfully labeled by opponents of regulation of agriculture, the Right to Farm Bill, but critics are calling it the Right to Harm Bill. This is a question that you have. What other states have it, and what does it say?
This has been done in two other states so far, Missouri and North Dakota. And in North Dakota, it passed easily. In Missouri, it was a big fight. They actually had to recount the vote. But this basically what it does is elevates the farming and ranching practices of farming and ranching into a constitutional right in our state. And it says that our legislature can't make any law to abridge their right to use agricultural technologies to farm and ranch forever, unless there's a compelling state interest.
And this is pushing back against what's happening in the other states across the country, laws being passed, for instance, demanding that chickens be kept in cages of certain sizes or that there be grazing. I mean, this is pushing back against that move.
That's right. And on the larger scheme of things, when it comes to right to farm, the bigger fight is between the Humane Society of the U.S. and farm bureaus across the country. Yeah. Humane Society says Big Ag just wants to be able to pollute at will and do whatever it wants. Farm bureaus say no, farmers are being crushed by regulations and something has to be done to stop that. There is some concern because this says that our legislature can't make certain laws. And I talked to one state representative, Donnie Condit, who had some real reservations about that.
Forever is a long time. 10, 15 years from now, if we vote this in and the legislature comes up almost with a crisis with agriculture, their hands are tied.
Oh, so that's fascinating there. You also spoke with local farmer Travis Snaithman, if I got
that's
that right,
yes,
who supports the right to farm because he worries that regulations passed in other states will now, you know, it's a slippery slope. It'll be coming to Oklahoma. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, no, his big worries were things like cage-free chicken laws or restrictions on GMOs.
What it's done is decrease that production. Those farmers out there can't compete on the national scale with other states that don't have those rules and regulations.
Boy, you know, when we travel over the state, you know, people, this is what they're talking about in Indian nations. Some of them are worried that, you know, they want regulation of pesticides that might come onto their lands. So what are you seeing? Any early polling to tell you how this question might fare?
The little bit of polling I've seen shows that supporters outweigh the opponents on this and that it would pass. But we don't know. We've still got a few weeks to go and there's a big media push coming from the no side. I know that much. And so we'll just have to see. Like I said, in Missouri, I would have expected it to pass easily there, too, but it didn't. It was very, very close.
We only got about a minute left. I want to ask about another question that would allow the sale of strong beer and wine in grocery stores. Now, some listeners across the country might be saying, well, we have that or we don't have that. What's the big deal? But it's unique here and in some surrounding states because they actually have to have special beer made for them?
That's right. Yeah, it's a weaker beer. It's a 3.2 beer that can be sold in grocery stores and convenience stores. Now, liquor stores can sell stronger beer, but only warm. So you can go get the beer water. It goes back to whenever Oklahoma came out of Prohibition and passed certain laws. And a lot of people say this is about, you know, modernizing our alcohol laws in Oklahoma. But it is very strange that we have to have this special watered down sort of beer for Oklahoma.
Yeah. So people are going to be asked on that question whether or not the stronger beer can be sold now in the grocery stores.
In grocery stores. And it goes beyond that. For example, right now in liquor stores, they can only sell liquor and strong beer. They can't sell corkscrews, things like that. So we have some very odd alcohol laws.
I'm happy to hear we only have a couple seconds that after Brexit, apparently there was a move for Oklahoma exit. Does that maybe die down a bit?
Yes, I think it has. Yes, absolutely.
Good. We want the state here. State Impact Reporter Logan Layden with us in the KGOU studios. Logan, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the people who recently received the National Humanities Medal from President Obama is Jose Andres, the Spanish-born chef and owner of more than a dozen restaurants, including Haleo in Washington, D.C., and The Bazaar in Beverly Hills. He was supposed to open a new restaurant in Donald Trump's new hotel in Washington, but after Trump's controversial comments about immigrants, Andres pulled out, Trump sued, and Andres countersued. In today's View from the Top, our recurring series of conversations with leaders, Jose Andres joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, and first, I have to congratulate you on your recent award, the National Humanities Medal from President Obama. What was that like for you to get that?
You know, when I received the call from the White House on behalf of President Obama, I was in Galapagos scuba diving. And I thought somebody was making fun of me. But I can tell you that, I used to be surrounded with people like Terry Gross or Ron Chernoff or so many others. It was kind of very humbling. And I'm a 47-year-old. I'm still a lot to do ahead. I hope I deserve it, but I can guarantee you that it's so many other people in the food industry that deserves a medal like this as much as me, but probably more. So that medal goes to the entire food industry. Hmm.
Well, I was counting it up, and I think I have been to 6 of your restaurants, Mini Bar, China Poblano, Oyamel, Haleo, Bazaar, and Zaytinya, all, by the way, very different restaurants. But you seem to like small plates. Why?
Well, they are very different restaurants because I believe more than a chef, I'm a storyteller. Hmm. And I tell stories through my restaurants. And when I go to a restaurant, when I go to a faraway country, and I know I only have a day or 2 or 3 to experience a city, I try to get as many experiences I can in the shortest period of time because I never know when I'm going to go back. For me, I don't know when people are going to come back to my restaurant. So the small plates, tapas, as we call them, for me is a great way for anybody to be able to experience my stories, the different chapters of my restaurants in one single meal. You really get a glimpse of the story I'm trying to share with you.
And you don't have to choose. You don't have to make a choice. You can just have a little bit of everything.
I mean, to me, sharing is so powerful. I always joke that I say that the fork and a knife, they were created to protect your plate from others taking a bite. And that as society became more peaceful, we began using them really to feed ourselves and feed others. So for me, yes, to think like you can be ordering different things, that everybody can be choosing 2 or 3 things, and that instead of putting the plate next to you, you are putting it in the middle of the table and you're sharing the bounty with everybody, I think to me is the most unique, fascinating way to eat today.
Well, and it's also a very different eating experience, and it changes the amount that you eat. I wonder if you've thought over the years about portion size.
Portion size, when we began, is not what was behind it. But the truth is that you give more control to the guest. Because in the tapas, a small plate environment, you don't have to order everything at once. So yes, that can be important for portion control. I'm a guy that believes that the chefs, we feed the few, but we are also interested in feeding the many. We know that many of us eat very well. Others have nothing to eat. Well, a concept like a small dish, chances are that always you're going to have less waste than in any other way.
Now you've got so many restaurants, but it wasn't that long ago that you were just getting started as a chef. And at this point, do you like the cooking part of it or the business side of it more?
The part I like the most still is the cooking. When I'm off, I'm cooking. When I'm on vacation, I'm cooking. When I'm working, I'm putting my finger in any sauce or tasting anything my chefs are doing in the restaurants or my creative team is doing at the home office. So the cooking to me is really what keeps me excited.
What do you like to cook when you're not working?
What I know is that I don't like to repeat the same dish twice, but I like the big pot. I always dream of the one pot that can feed the world. So in Spain, we have a very traditional pan and is used to cook rice, and we call it the paella pan. And you can make the most traditional, like paella valenciana with rabbit and chicken and green beans, a little bit of tomato, olive oil over a wood-burning fire. Or you can be creative and cook any other rice you want, from lobsters from Maine to who knows what. So the paella pan for me is great because you only need one spoon, one pan, one fire, and there you can be feeding 10 people or 100. And that's very powerful.
One of the things that I've heard from my sister, who is a chef, is that there is a shortage of chefs. It's very difficult to go out and find chefs. Is that something that you've experienced, and why do you think it is?
I don't think it's only chefs. I think it's the entire food industry. We need to remember that in America alone, the food industry, we are slightly over 10% of the workforce. Today, sometimes you are listening, sometimes some politicians talking about immigration, that there are way too many immigrants, way too many undocumented, and they are talking about building a wall. People of America, I could open more restaurants if I had the possibility to hire the people to fill those restaurants. Today we have, yes, a shortfall not only of chefs, cooks, dishwashers, waiters, bartenders. We need farmers. So the big message here is, why are we listening one message when the reality is that, talking as a businessman, today I have a hard time hiring people. So let's make sure that we approve laws, let's make sure that we pass immigration reform, and let's make sure that restaurateurs like me, we have the workforce that will help keep moving America forward.
Since you mentioned the wall, I do have to ask you, and you can say whatever you're able to say, but you are in a lawsuit with Donald Trump right now. Is there anything you want to say about that?
This is almost like the Tom Hanks movie, Forrest Gump. It's not much to say. The only thing I can say is that as a new American, 2-year-old only American, I love this country. I've been here over 25 years. I have 3 American beautiful daughters. I believe in what this country stands for. And what I know is that this country stands for inclusion. This country doesn't stand for building walls. This country stands for building bridges. This country stands for being the light of hope for so many here at home and so many overseas. And that's the America we're going to keep having. That's what I can tell you.
Is it strange, though, to be at the center of a part of the presidential campaign, in this unbelievable presidential campaign that we've been experiencing, that you, a chef, are in the middle of it?
Well, it's not. I think this only tells you that we can all make a difference. I love that chefs in America, they are outspoken about many issues. You can see Tom Colicchio from Top Chef in Congress fighting for a more fair farm bill. Or you can have chefs opening restaurants like Roy Choi open in the inner cities, a fast food restaurant that will feed people that they never had a restaurant close to the neighborhood. Today, chefs were here used to be part of the solutions that will make America better. But America is awesome already. We all have to believe that by every day working smarter and harder, America will always be that country that we all believe in, that we all dream of. So to be part of not, I didn't have any Sioux. It's the first time in my life I've been under a Sioux. But I can tell you one thing. I got the chance 10 years ago to have Chapter 11. And you know what I did? We decided not to do it, even was the smartest thing to do. Our lawyers told me, Jose, go Chapter 11. It's the right thing to do. You are playing by the rules. We didn't go Chapter 11. We didn't fire anybody. We made the restaurant successful. We pay our bills. We didn't let anybody behind. And here, 10 years later, the city keeps moving. My restaurants keep moving. My employees keep moving. And that's what I'm proud of.
So looking forward, what genre of restaurant would you like to open up that you haven't done yet?
One restaurant that I'm about to open, very close here at the new MGM Casino, right here in Maryland, minutes away from downtown Washington, D.C. It's going to be fish, and it's going to be about American fish, an homage to the Chesapeake Bay. But the restaurant I really want to open in the years to come, I'm a boy that born in Spain. Jewish cooking somehow always was very important. And I want to open a Sephardic Spanish restaurant based on 1492, when unfortunately history, Jewish had many had to leave Spain. But something magic happened, unfortunately, in such a bad moment. The many Jewish people ended in so many different countries around the Mediterranean. They brought with them their traditions from Spain, and in every country they arrived, they created kind of a new cooking. I want to do really a restaurant where somehow we are celebrating the diaspora of Jewish people around the Mediterranean and do a true Sephardic restaurant. Mm. That's the one I hope I'll be opening in the next 5-10 years.
Sounds great. Well, Jose Andres, chef owner of Think Food Group, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Today, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to 3 British-born scientists who all work in the U.S., David Thewlis, Duncan Haldane, and Michael Kosterlitz. They got the award for their discoveries in condensed matter physics. The Nobel Committee says their research, quote, opened the door on an unknown world where matter exists in strange states. Brad Marston is a professor of physics at Brown University. He joins us by Skype. And Brad, I know that one of your colleagues, Michael Kosterlitz, who's a fellow professor at Brown, is one of the winners. So probably an exciting day there.
It's very exciting. We're all talking about it in the department.
Well, and tell us exactly what the discovery was here that won the prize.
Well, prior to the work of Kosterlitz and Thewlis, people had been studying phase transitions in matter. That is like when a solid melts, if you heat up a solid enough, it'll melt. If ice is heated up enough, it'll turn into water. And all of those transitions were marked by some change in order, like ice is a crystal, but water obviously isn't. And what Kosterlitz and Thewlis discovered is that you can have a phase transition that isn't characterized by having a change in order. It doesn't have to go from, say, a crystal to a liquid. Hmm. And that was a real big discovery that they found. It really was the first instance of understanding how topology plays a role in physics.
And why is it important for us to know that?
Well, first of all, nature does this. Although they had a theory, a model, it was soon discovered that there were various systems in nature where these kinds of transitions occur. And it led to a greater appreciation for the role of topology, how the overall shape of things matters in understanding physics.
And a Nobel spokesman said that these discoveries are theoretical and beautiful, and that while they could have concrete practical applications in electronics and computing, that's not what the prize was awarded for. Did it surprise you that these guys got the prize for this?
No, it just it surprised me it took them so long to give them the prize for this. We all expected that it would happen at some point.
Well, what are the concrete applications of these discoveries?
There aren't any particular concrete applications that I can think of in terms of a technology, for instance. There may be a few, but the greater significance is it's the intellectual richness of these ideas and how they've found ever greater uses in understanding different aspects of nature, all the way up to cosmology.
What's the next step in condensed matter physics? What's the next thing that has to be figured out?
Oh, well, there's so many different forms of matter that we're trying to understand. We still don't understand high-temperature superconductivity, for instance. That was discovered in the 80s. And some of the ideas of Koslitz and Thales and others are invoked to try to understand that physics, but it's still really a mystery. And the use of topology has become greater and greater over time. So we have a new class of materials called topological insulators that really use the physics of topology in a deep and profound way.
That's Brad Marston, who's a professor of physics at Brown University, speaking with us about the Nobel Prize in Physics, which was awarded today. Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
When I was growing up, on the occasional really nice day, we got to have class outside. Well, for some preschool students outside Seattle, that's the case every day. They go to school outside. Katie Campbell from Here and Now contributor EarthFix has the story.
A group of preschoolers, some barefoot, are running through the forest. A four-year-old girl stops to pick up a small brown twig and shows it to her teacher, Erin Kenny.
What is it?
Cedar.
It is cedar. You're right. Wait, how come it's not green?
Because
it's old and it's just the stick of it. What happens to things when they fall onto the ground?
They're decomposed. Stick and cold.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it will decompose.
This is a typical morning at Cedarsong Nature School, a preschool with no walls or desks and no worksheets or flashcards. These kids aren't diving into reading, writing, and arithmetic, but Kenny says that doesn't mean they aren't learning.
There's great learning taking place with young children. When they're just allowed to explore nature, they're learning all kinds of valuable principles about gravity and texture and shapes and colors and all the things that you might expect to see in a preschool curriculum. They're just doing it outdoors and naturally at their own pace.
A chemical for adventure.
You ready for an adventure, Lillian?
This way.
Cedarsong opened in 2006 on Vashon Island, a short ferry ride from Seattle. It's the first forest kindergarten in the United States. Now, a decade later, the outdoor school idea has spread. Dozens of similar schools have sprouted across the nation. And that's led some people to wonder if outdoor schools could help solve a problem. In a park in Seattle, 3-year-old Charlie McGlynn Wright is climbing a boulder with her mom, Annie. At the top, Charlie looked down at her dad, Teddy, with pride at her accomplishment.
Charlie, are you up way high?
Yeah.
Did you climb up all by yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I climb up all by myself without you?
Probably not without an adult.
A lot.
And I know you do.
When Charlie was born, her parents felt pressured to immediately start looking for a preschool. Their search confirmed what other parents had warned them, that many Seattle preschools have years-long wait lists and tuition that rivals the cost of attending college. Teddy McGlynn Wright works for the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative. He recognized that a lack of affordable, high-quality preschools means children from low-income families and racial minorities can end up falling behind. He wondered if outdoor schools could be a solution.
Because the cost of the building, especially in a place like Seattle where you've got really high property values, and like it's hard to compete when you're this, you know, a school or a nonprofit. But if we cut out the building, that cuts out easily, 30 to 40% of the cost of running a preschool.
So he decided to help start an outdoor preschool called Tiny Trees. For the cost of opening one brick and mortar classroom serving 20 students a day, they're opening 11 classes that serve about 150 students. The pilot program began this school year in public parks around Seattle. Tuition is set on a sliding scale, with the city subsidizing part of the cost based on a student's family income. More than half of the students at Tiny Trees rely on some kind of financial help. Monica Liang Aguirre is the director of the Early Learning Division for the Seattle Department of Education. She says her team is always looking to support new preschools like Tiny Trees that are taking an innovative approach.
And I think it would be fabulous if we could expand access to high-quality preschool because of more outdoor preschools. It's not for everybody. It's certainly not the solution to the issue, but it's certainly one way to address the space shortage.
Her team will be evaluating Tiny Trees during its pilot phase.
Tiny Trees has been very eager to participate in all of our child outcome assessments and making sure that their children are developing the vocabulary and math skills. But at the end of the day, is this going to be something that is that really going to change outcomes for kids? And that's what we look for.
Charlie was one of the first to be enrolled. From up on the boulder, she starts a careful descent, her parents coaching her down.
Just like that. Good job, Charlie.
Wow. That was a big jump.
For McGlynn Wright, helping Charlie develop confidence to navigate the outdoors is just as important as other preschool lessons.
There are a lot of, black and brown folks, a lot of folks who look like me, who look like her, who don't feel welcome in outdoor spaces, who, whether they're in, city parks, or whether we're talking about the backcountry. And I wanted to make sure that from a really early age, she got the sense of, I belong here and that this place belongs to me.
And he wants all of his daughter's classmates, regardless of their race, to develop a lifelong bond with the natural world. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Campbell in Seattle.
Well, there was another earthquake here in Oklahoma today, a 3.1 just after 7 a.m. near Stroud, about 65 miles from where we are in Norman. Yawn. There have been more than 500 magnitude 3 or greater earthquakes this year in Oklahoma, compared to 156 or so in California. The scientific opinion is that they are caused by wastewater injection in the disposal wells used in oil and gas production, including fracking, which is pumping fluids directly into rocks, but largely just standard oil and gas production, drilling in the ground. Let's get an update on earthquakes with State Impact Reporter Joe Wirtz here in the KGOU studios. And Joe, you've explained this to us before, how the drilling brings up oil, but also water from long ago oceans.
That's right. They call it produced water, and this is a salty, briny, toxic water that comes up, right? And it's the remnants of these old oceans that used to cover this part of the continent. So this toxic water comes to the surface with the oil and gas, and the producers don't want it. They want the oil and gas. But more importantly, we don't want that toxic water anywhere near the surface.
Because, right. It used to be stored in lakes and things, and that was not a good idea.
Absolutely not a good idea. It's toxic. It's bad for just about everything. So the idea is to put it back down deep underground. And this is sort of the government-approved economically feasible way of getting rid of this waste.
Well, and then that has caused disruption underground. And, being here, I've been to Oklahoma before, but it just is always stunning to drive around. You see these derricks everywhere. They look like these nodding pterodactyls, and they go up and down on people's lawns downtown.
Right. People's lawns downtown. Essentially, the lawn of the state capitol has a working pump jack on it. So the scale of the oil and gas industry here in Oklahoma, and a lot of states, these big energy states, is really something to consider.
Right.
And when we talk about these disposal wells, they are key to the production, right? We have to have these disposal wells currently to have the oil and gas.
Okay, so we talked to you about a month ago. There was a 5.8 magnitude over Labor Day. So what's happened since then?
Well, that was Oklahoma's largest earthquake on record, and scientists say it's likely linked to these disposal wells. So what's happened? People are worried. People are scared, especially if you're living near the shaking.
Well, were some of them shut down?
Yes. The oil and gas regulator, the state regulator, shut down some wells. Also, the EPA in a nearby county, which is controlled federally, they shut down some wells too. So they're doing a combo, shutting down wells and slowing down others.
Well, so there's been a slowdown. Mm-hmm. But there's been a slowdown also in the rate of these 3.0 earthquakes.
Right.
But then there was that big one, which caused a lot of concern. So, Joe, do we know if the slowdown in the rate of earthquakes is because people are slowing down in their exploration because of the earthquakes, or because there's a slowdown in demand for oil? In which case, that means that if there's more demand, then that drilling might go back up and the earthquake rate might go up as well.
Well, you asked essentially the essential question: is the earthquake rate slowdown due to low oil and gas prices and low activity, or is it due to the regulatory actions? Scientists say it's probably a combination of both. The question: they know that the regulations work; they can see it in the sensors. When they slow down a well, the shaking slows down. But oil prices are low, activity is low. We just don't know.
Don't know why the slowdown is. Meanwhile, we just in the minute we have, you tell us that what they really want to do is be able to come up with predictive measures.
Right. So they want to be able to look at these micro seismic signals, these things you can't even remotely feel, and look for something that might predict when this is going to happen. Look for a pattern that they can use to predict this stuff more accurately, so we know if things are getting risky.
Well, we're sitting tight. Maybe we'll feel one. Joe Wirtz, an earthquake.
Welcome to Oklahoma.
Right. An earthquake expert and a state impact reporter here in the KGOU studios in Oklahoma. Joe, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Fast food is getting a little less fast. That finding comes from an annual survey by QSR Magazine, which timed drive-through service at 15 of the nation's biggest restaurant chains. Wendy's was the fastest. The slowest was Starbucks, which averaged about 5 minutes per order. We're joined now by QSR's Sam Okus. And Sam, tell us more about what you found.
Sure. So what we're finding is that drive-thrus are, on the whole, slowing down. And this is a trend we've been watching for 3 or 4 years now. What's happening is that as the fast food industry moves toward more high-quality ingredients and certainly a more high-quality experience for customers, that's taking a toll on the drive-thru. So drive-thru times, service speed times, are on the whole slowing down as many as 30, 40 seconds.
And does that make sense from a business perspective to focus more on the dining experience inside than on the drive-thru outside?
It does. So what we're hearing from the companies is that they're more concerned about order accuracy and the customer experience. So if you drive off a lot after getting your fast food through the drive-thru, you're going to be more angry if your order was inaccurate or if the employee was rude to you than you will be if it took a long time to get it. So the companies are recognizing that what they want to do is get you off the lot happy and pleased with your experience, not necessarily get you off the lot as fast as possible.
So we mentioned Wendy's and Starbucks. That's surprising that would be the one that is the slowest because they're usually not making very much food.
I was a little bit surprised by this as well. What I think I chalk this up to is when you think about Starbucks, a lot of their beverages do take a while to make. So these are more specialty beverages. This is not a drink that you just pour from a tap and pass it out the window. This is something that takes a little bit more time. So I think that that's probably why Starbucks has seen some slower times. I'd also say that Starbucks doesn't have as many drive-thrus as many of these other companies. It's not as big of an investment as it is for something like McDonald's or Burger King. So they're spending some time now on it, figuring out how to get the drive-thru right, but they're not as focused on the drive-thru operation as many of these other companies are.
And at the other end of the scale, Dunkin' Donuts is pretty fast.
Dunkin' is very fast. Yeah, what we're seeing is Dunkin' Donuts has about 181 seconds, so about 3 minutes through the drive-thru. This was the second fastest time to Wendy's. So Dunkin' has definitely perfected this operation more so than Starbucks. But that's also because, again, Dunkin' has a lot of drive-thru locations, many more than Starbucks. So this is something where they have a lot of the experience in this operation.
If you're building a fast food restaurant today, does it make sense to build a drive-thru? Because that's extra real estate that you've got to pay for. You've got to have that. Does it make sense to have a drive-thru in 2016?
Yeah, so it definitely depends. I mean, when you look at something like fast casual restaurants, which are these upscale fast food restaurants, such as Panera Bread, Taco Cabana, PDQ, as we've studied in our research, it does make sense to have a drive-thru in certain locations because there are some cities, I'm thinking of something like a Dallas. Dallas really is a driving city. It's not like a New York, which is more of a walking city. So if you're in a driving city, it really behooves you to have a drive-thru because many people will experience your restaurant through the drive-thru rather than getting out of the car. But you're right, it does cost more. You need more real estate. You need more employees focused on that drive-thru operation. And many of these companies are seeing 70% of their business go through the drive-thru. So this is nothing to sneeze at. This is a major operation. So you have to figure out if it works for your company, because if it doesn't make sense in a certain location, the drive-thru really is a major, major system to have to put in place.
And when it comes to accuracy, which your survey finds is going up, is that directly tied to taking more time? Is that a direct connection between a longer wait time for your food and a more accurate order?
It seems to be, yeah. The companies are telling their employees, look, focus more on the order accuracy. Do things like repeat the order three times to the customer to make sure you're getting everything right. I know some of the companies have instituted that policy, doing things like having order confirmation boards that repeats the order back to them. And so by focusing on these things, yes, it might take a little bit more time to repeat the order back to the customer, but you're guaranteeing that you're getting them their food correctly.
One more thing I want to ask you about on the issue of Starbucks, the slowest in your survey. They have started to experiment with walking the coffee out to you at your car as opposed to you going through a drive-thru.
Yes, that's correct. They're trying a lot of new things, and actually a lot of these companies are. One of the other things that Starbucks is doing that I think is really interesting and unique is they're trying video boards. So you can actually see the barista that you're ordering from, and you can see the person who's making the beverage for you.
From your car?
From your car, because I think that that adds this personal layer to it. It adds a very personal experience for the customer.
And are drive-thrus any different today than they were 20 years ago, really, or is it pretty much fundamentally the same?
I think what they had 20 years ago was more of a focus on speed. Drive-thru was more tailored to how quickly can we get you through. As recently as 2004, 2005, we were seeing many of these companies average something like 140 seconds, 150 seconds. Wendy's was the all-time fastest, I believe, in 2003 at 116 seconds through the drive-thru. This year, they're the fastest at 169. So you see how much it's slowed down. And I think that's largely because customers are more demanding of a quality experience now. Yes, they're in a hurry. Yes, they want convenience and speed. But I think they're placing more value on the overall experience, and the companies are responding to that.
That's Sam Okus, the editorial director of Food News Media, talking with us about a new survey from QSR Magazine on fast food drive-thrus. Sam, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young from KGOU in Oklahoma. This is Here and Now.